CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 116 with Dr. Priya Narang, insight into innovating new surgical procedures. Now this you're going to like. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest. That's Dr. Priya Narang. Now you've seen her video. In fact, she just won a medal at the ASCRS for a very important advance that you made to help some of our complex cataract patients. Why don't you tell us about that?
Hi, Uday. And the foremost, let me tell you, I'm so honored to be here on this show of yours. And, you know, Cataract Coach is something that we all look forward to. It's not only for young people, ophthalmologists, but, you know, even senior people and everybody out there, you know, it's fun watching what you actually show. And it's really, I'm really honored to be here. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you so much. I love this educational platform.
Of course. We all learn together. That's the best part.
Absolutely. I do agree to that. Perfect. So, yeah, coming up to the video that I just won at the ASCRS, it was in the refractive section. It was the high impact poles, like in 1.5 minute video, what would be the maximum pearl, you know, like that you would try to pass on to everybody. So it was about that, and it was about, you know, higher order aberrations and doing a pinhole pupilloplasty in those cases, and how you can actually customize, you know, the size of the pupil for the benefit of the patients. So yeah, that's the video that it actually won at the ASCRS.
Wow. Yeah, I actually saw the video. So it was a complex patient who had not only radial keratotomy, but yes, very large astigmatic cuts, which induced a lot of astigmatism. Tell me about the case.
Absolutely. Uday, I would like to emphasize for the benefit of all that, you know, many times when we do pentachem or any other topography analysis, you know, many times we skip seeing what would be the higher order aberration for that patient. So this is the first thing, you know, we need to see in these patients, because these are the patients, you know, when if even if we take them for a routine cataract surgery, they are, and even if you go in with premium IOLs or you do anything, these patients are not going to be happy in the post-operative period. In spite of we doing the best for them. So I think higher order aberrations is one thing. And, you know, we have documented, like, you know, patients with higher order aberrations ranging from 15, 20, 30, like that. These patients with radial keratotomy, that's huge, because the normal values are something around 0.3 microns.
Yeah, less than one.
Absolutely. And if you have something like that, you know, these patients, they're actually not very happy, because their vision, even if they see, their quality of vision is actually compromised, you know. Mm-hmm. So the case that was there, it was the case with radial keratotomy, you know, around 16 radial keratotomy marks on the surface of the cornea, and along with astigmatic keratotomy also, because I think maybe the previous surgeon, they tried to neutralize the astigmatism by putting the arcuate keratotomy marks and all that. So this was a very tough case to go ahead with. So yeah, and in these patients, you know, one of the most important thing which I also highlighted during my presentation was that it is not, you know, that one size of pupil that fits all. This is a very important thing. You know, you cannot give a you need to create a customized pupil size for these patients. Some patients will be happy with 1 millimeter pinhole, some will be happy with 1.5, and some with 2 millimeter. But most of the cases that I have seen, they are mostly happy with 1 and 1.5. And the higher the order, the higher order aberration, the smaller is the size of the pupil that, you know, usually these patients, they get comfortable with. So that's one aspect. But the second aspect is to create that size of pinhole during the surgery. So that's another aspect, you know, which comes up for these cases. So it's actually very challenging to do such cases.
No, for sure. So I think we often focus on the lower order aberrations, which is sphere and cylinder. Did we hit the refractive target? But in your case like this, when you have such a large degree of higher order aberrations, though you may hit the plano sphere, the visual quality is just terrible.
Absolutely. So that is what, you know, I was highlighting in my presentation, that the most important take-home message was that, you know, one size of pupil does not fit all. And the second is, you have to center your pinhole on the Purkinje-1 reflex. So that's another, you know,
the surgical. The first Purkinje reflex.
The first
Purkinje reflex. The anterior surface of the cornea.
Absolutely, absolutely. So these are the two important points. And the third is, you have to create a pupil of that size during the surgery.
Now, because you have the benefit of the pinhole, are you also aiming for maybe just a little bit of post-op myopia? Or are you still keeping a plan for refractive goal?
We try, see, with pinhole, it doesn't make much difference. Like, even if you are a bit on either side, it doesn't make much difference. We try to go neutral, like you would try to go in with a plano kind of a thing. But even if you're patient, you get an extended depth of focus with a pinhole kind of a thing. So that in itself takes care of, a wide range of dioptric difference that you might get in these patients because of, the complex IOL power calculations that go on. And we all know how fluctuating the vision is for the patients with RK and all. So everything is being taken care by the pinhole. But yes, when it comes to the surgical front, what we try to do is, we will try to create something like, you go ahead with the plano calculations that you have a plano or maybe a half diopter of myopia, something like that.
So how do you determine the correct pupil size? So you see a patient in your clinic, you see on your scan that there's a lot of hyoid aberrations. So you
Absolutely.
can see they've got a distorted cornea from radiokeratotomy or maybe keratoconus or maybe some other corneal scar. How do you figure out, do I do 1 millimeter, 1.5, 2 millimeter pupil? How do you know?
Yeah, we have a pinhole device for that, Uday. So Dr. Jack Holliday, I would say, he devised it, and it was in discussion with him that we came forward with this. And actually, it's a pinhole device where you have pinholes of different sizes. Like, it starts from 0.5 to 1, 1.5, 2. It goes up to 4 millimeter size and with an increment of 0.5 millimeters. So in the preoperative period, when you have the patient with you, what you have to do is you have to place that pinhole in front of the patient's eye, right? And you have to make the patient see through the pinhole, and you have to ask your patient that, okay, which pupil size you like? I mean, which is the pupil size that gives you the max vision, or what is that you would like to have in the postoperative period? So the patient immediately, they will keep on rotating that and seeing, and then they'll tell you, okay, this suits me fine. So you know that, okay, maybe 1.5 or a 1 or a 2 millimeter, whatever it is. So that's how we come to know that, okay, this is what the patient actually wants during the surgery.
Well, that makes sense. You have the patient check themselves. Now,
Absolutely.
obviously, the downside of a pinhole is you'll have the upside is you have a lot more depth of focus. You can address a lot of these refractive errors. Hyoid aberrations can be minimized. But what about loss of light? Do the patients have issues with functioning in dim lighting or
Perfect. Absolutely. That's a great question, Uday. What actually happens in these patients, mostly these patients, they do not complain of anything in the postoperative period. But yes, we do. We did a study wherein we had one or two cases who complained of, decreased vision in the evening or at the night time because of the light. In those patients, what we would consider doing is that we would just do a little bit of YAC capsulotomy and give a slight blast onto the edge of the pupil that has been created. So the pupil size will slightly increase in size from what it was actually. By and large, that these patients are so happy and jumping around in the operative period because, they have never seen anything like that in their life.
Of course.
They are so happy with the quality of the vision that they actually forget about what is, your adaptation in the dark and what is in the light. They're just seeing everything brilliantly. But yes, when it comes to some of the patients, they might complain. You can do a YAG and, you can get things right. Yeah,
Now,
that's the.
one other question is, well, how do you now examine the retina with a 1.5 millimeter pupil?
Absolutely. That's another nice question. What actually we do is that, Uday, when you put the dilating drops in these patients, the pupil usually dilates where the suture is not passed through, So what happens is that, suppose, for example, you have a 1.5 millimeters pinhole that you have created, but when you instill the drop, we have done a study on this too. So when you instill the drop, the pupil size increases wherever the sutures are not there. So that gives you quite a good view of the fundus. But let us take into consideration that even that does not happen. So maybe then we need to take help of, wide field imaging in these patients. So they give you a perfect view et cetera. And maybe, again, if we increase the severity of the situation, if patient has some more complaints, maybe you might have to use the UBM for the periphery to analyze. And even if we go one step ahead of that, if we need to do something, the best thing that, you know, if a retina surgeon wants, you can just cut those sutures so it's just open if you need to do some, you know, posterior segment intervention. So it goes like that.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, important to mention that you're not using the old technique of a purse string or pupil cerclage. Rather, you're doing the newer technique of Agarwal's four-throw pupilplasty. Explain about that.
Absolutely. So what actually happens with the purse string is that, you know, you create a totally concentric pupil during the surgery, and you try to create it, although it's a bit tricky and a bit difficult and a time consuming procedure to do that. But coming up to single pass four throw pupilloplasty, I would say it's a very simple procedure. And we have an advantage. That's what I said. When we do a pinhole, we have an advantage of all those areas where the sutures are not passed. These areas can dilate. Otherwise, it's difficult, you know, when you have a suture going all around, it's not going to dilate much in the post-op because you have already tightened up the sphincter.
Of course. And you have a newer method as well now, I've seen, like the suturing. Tell me about that. Are you suturing on the backside?
Absolutely. So there's a very interesting story with that, Uday. You know, once I was doing it was a complex case, and like I was doing a pupil repair in one of the patients. So my daughter, she's also a medical student. So she was there. She was watching my surgery throughout. And then she says that, okay, mom, you have done a nice thing, but I don't like those sutures on the anterior surface of the iris. They don't look good, because she was actually seeing on a big screen. Oh, so she didn't like those troubles of sutures. That she said, we need to have something, you know, where you don't see anything in the anterior chamber. Let's do something like that. So, and yes, that set me thinking that, okay, yeah. So then I came up with the reverse four-throw pupilloplasty, you know, wherein I also call it as iris stapling, Uday. Because, you know, you don't see anything in the anterior chamber, but you have a pupil repair. It's just like, you know, bringing two surfaces of the iris together, and there's nothing in the anterior chamber. And, you know, the beauty is that, you know, it cannot be even detected with an OCT. You don't see anything in the anterior chamber because the suture goes behind. So that's a very perfect, I mean, it's a very nice thing to do. I do in some of my cases wherever it is actually needed. The only thing is that, you know, what we have to do differently with the reverse four-throw is that, you know, you have to start suturing from the periphery to the center of the pupil, because your suture is behind, your knot is behind, and you have to cut those knots.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So yeah.
From the outside in, you have to go.
Absolutely. You got that. Because you cannot first suture the center. Okay, you can do that. But then when you have to do the periphery, how does your needle go so much behind? Access. It doesn't. So you have to do the periphery first and then come to the center. So that's one surgical trick for that technique that needs to be adopted. Otherwise, you cannot do that.
Well, what's so interesting is how, like your daughter, how the next generation, the younger generation.
Absolutely.
These things a little differently and says, hey, why not this? And that's kind of neat how we advance from generation to generation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that is, you know, that's how actually, Uday, you know, various techniques or methods or things, they come evolving. When you have young people with you, you know, they would question you that, okay, why are you doing this? Why don't you do this? Even this would work for you. So I say, okay, that's nice.
That's a nice way of thinking, because I don't know if someone like me, I wouldn't have thought of that. I would not have raised the question your daughter raised. It wouldn't strike me.
Yeah, it just happens, like, you know, and I really found my results to be very good in these cases, you know. It's beautiful. If you want, I can share with you some of the post-operative pictures of my patients who have got these done, and you need to identify for me where the knot is and where the iris has come together.
Right. Well, we're
so going to show that would be a test for the cataract coach.
Yeah, we do cataract quiz, our famous series on cataract quiz. Yeah, I mean, The day after our podcast airs, we'll have your surgical video of how to do this technique. So if you listen to the podcast and you want to know, show me this technique, show me how it's done, show me the reverse, how you suture on the backside, that video is going to be the day after this podcast.
Oh, lovely. Thank you. Thank you.
We'll host that too. Now, how do you compare this to, in the USA, we have one of these pinhole IOLs available, which basically gives a central zone, I think it's 1.36 millimeters. It's fixed.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, the most important thing that that's the difference between the IOL and the pinhole pupilloplasty is that, you know, you can customize the size of the pupil with the pinhole pupilloplasty and not with the pinhole IOL. But the downside is that, you know, it's technically demanding, Uday.
Right.
Doing a pinhole pupilloplasty is not that easy, especially for somebody who has never done an iris repair. So that's going to be a difficult thing. You need to be very well versed with doing an iris repair to get that pupil on the Purkinje reflex exactly on bang on center. So that's one important thing. The another advantage is that the cost factor. There's nothing, you know, the pinhole IOLs, they do cost a bit, but with
Sure.
the suture, you just need a suture for doing a pinhole pupilloplasty. So that's another thing. The third thing is that you can decenter the pupil in cases of corneal opacity. If you have a corneal opacity and you want to do a create a pinhole, you know, you can decenter this the pupil a little bit away from the corneal opacity with a pupilloplasty, but you gotta do it with an IOL. So that's another thing. But coming up to this, you know, somebody would say that, okay, why do we actually want to decenter the pupil? Because if we do not decenter the pupil a bit, the patient is not going to see anything through the corneal opacity and the higher order aberrations and everything remains as such. So, and it has been documented also that even, you know, there is a limit to which the cones in the retina, you know, they can adjust to the shift in the positioning of the pupil. Along with that,
Wow.
it is just an adaptation that takes place. So that's another thing that needs to be taken into consideration. So these are a few things, you know, which are quite different. But then this is an advantage. You know, we all know you do any technique, you have an advantage. You also have disadvantages. So it's something like that.
Right. Makes a ton of sense. Now, this is the 10-0 polypropylene on the CIF4 needle.
Absolutely.
So yeah, that's the suture you're using here. Yeah, you don't want to be confused. Don't use 10-0 nylon. It's not going to last as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a 10-0 polypropylene suture. We often use a 9-0 also. Even that can be used. So it's fine.
Yeah, makes a ton of sense. Now, do you have any other pearls for doing this? One of the challenges I found is that you have to really not let the needle get caught in any corneal tissue as you exit the peritonitis.
Absolutely.
So are you using the trocar-assisted version?
Yes, I do use even a trocar-assisted version, especially in cases, you know, where I know that I have to do a multiple repair all around, especially in traumatic cases where you have, you know, you have to do an iridodialysis, you even have to do a pupil-centric method. So these are the cases wherein I would use a trocar. But if it is just a small coloboma kind of a thing, you know, which I just need to repair, then maybe I might not even put a trocar. But by and large, we use trocars. Yes, it prevents the entrapment of the corneal fibers. But coming up again to the fact that, you know, if anybody is not very well versed with using trocars, what they can do is that, you know, a small tip, which even you know, that whenever we enter inside the anterior chamber, you have to enter with a sliding movement, you know, through the corneal paracentesis so that you are sure that there's no corneal fiber into that needle. So that's
Right.
one small trick. Yes, you
Yeah,
can
so
use that.
evidently you can, if you're not going to use a trocar, you're going to go right into para, you got to wiggle the needle back and forth
Absolutely.
so you're not going to
Yes.
literally grab some corneal tissue.
Absolutely. So there has to be a free movement of that needle. So that ensures that there's no corneal fiber out there. So these are small, you know, tips which you get to know only when you start doing things. So
Well, the trocar is actually very easy. It's a retina style trocar, but you're just placing that trocar into your paracentesis. So basically, it's like an extra tunnel in the para that'll guide the needle out of the para very easily.
yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what we do is, what I do, Uday, is that, you know, when I place the trocar, it is about 0.5 millimeters from the limbus. So it goes through the limbal, the scleral area, and it remains so firmly out there, you know, there is no chance of any slippage or anything. So it works beautifully. And the idea, you know, you can just sway that trocar. If you have, like, you can easily correct about two quadrants of iris repair can easily be done by just swaying the trocar and even maybe more. So that's how. And We all know that when we have to place a trocar, it always has to be in the direction that is opposite to wherever the dialysis, the iridodialysis is there, so that it's easy for you to go through that, through your needle to go through the trocar.
Now, if you have a patient where you're, let's say you're going to bring the pupil down for the pupilloplasty, and you're going to place the sutures, would you place them 10 o'clock and 3 o'clock? Or I'm sorry, at 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock? Or will you place it 6 and 12 o'clock?
It
Would
doesn't
not
make
matter.
much. It doesn't make much difference for this. You can do it. I mean, depending upon your positioning, you can do either way, vertical or a horizontal. You can do any way. It depends on that. Yeah. But yes, what? So that's like a vertical and a horizontal kind of a repair, which is there. But Uday, for IFIS, for the cases with IFIS, where you have that floppy iris coming all the way through the corneal incision, coming up back, and you need to reposit that iris tissue inside. And now the trick that we have started adopting is that, doing a vertical. I mean, if you have an iris prolapse, for example, at 12 o'clock position, so you would do it on the either side, and you will try to pull the iris away from the corneal incision. What actually happens is that if you go horizontal in these cases, you have that knot and the bulge of the iris tissue because you have passed the needle through the flabby iris. So it is going to remain a bit retracted towards the corneal incision even after you do a pupil repair in that area. So like you have to go in the direction opposite and try to pull that entire thing away from that area, and then it looks beautiful.
Right. So if you make your incision, let's say you'll have and you have floppy iris, you put the two sutures on 90 degrees on either side. So when you tighten it up, it pulls the iris away from your incision.
Away.
You keep prolapsing out. Okay, makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you're not passing your needle through the flabby, that iris, because that tissue already does not have any strength in it to hold a suture. So it's going to be retracted a bit towards the corneal incision.
Wow, these are such great pearls. Wow, these are unusual cases, but when you get into one of them, it can take a long time. So, we should, if you're a new surgeon who wants to try this technique, are there any other helpful hints? Like, would you do retrobulbar block? Would you give yourself like an hour in the operating room, just more time? What other advice do you have if you've never tried it before?
I think for a new surgeon, ideally it has to be done in a peribulbar block or a retrobulbar block, whatever you're using, because you cannot touch the iris just like that.
Right.
So that's very important thing to do. And I would suggest that anybody, if you are going to do this, you need to actually practice it before you go into a human eye, because the iris tissue is so fragile. And especially, in these complicated cases, these irises, they behave differently from a normal iris. They do not behave in the same way. These irises, I have seen so many cases with the traumatic cases that I do, is that, the iris tissue would just give way wherever you put the needle.
Right.
So, because these iris tissue, I don't know, they have lost the elasticity or something in them, and they're quite different from other iris tissue. For example, if you have a coloboma, you can do the iris repair very well, because that iris tissue, although there is a defect in the iris,
It's healthy, strong.
it's healthy. It's healthy, but not the other iris tissues. For example, traumatic cases or whatever, especially traumatic cases, they behave very differently. So
Yeah,
that's
that's true.
yeah.
The tissue is a lot wimpier of the traumatic cases. They can be even ischemic. And then I always look carefully at the pre-op consultation. If the iris already looks a little atrophic, I know if I pass a suture right through it, you could cheese wire it.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's another teaching point that you just mentioned. Never pass a needle through the atrophic iris, because it's not going to hold back. It's going to cut through, and you are going to have a tough time again. So yeah, that's one
Another
thing you
pearl,
must.
yeah, another pearl I've learned in my patient population, which may be a little different than yours, is the patient with the light blue colored irises. Those irises are even wimpier. The brown
Oh.
irises are actually thicker and easier to work with. The really pale blue ones are tougher. They're so
Okay.
much, they're much more fragile.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, like, Here in India, we have those brown irises. We don't
Yeah.
get those, blue irises. But yeah,
No.
it's good. I came to know from you. And the only thing is that, with the brown irises, there is a lot of pigment release in the post-operative period. I don't know how it is about in the blue eyes, but there's a lot of pigment release occurring in these eyes. And, in the post-operative period, you might even get an inflammation out there. If these eyes, they tend to give you much more of inflammation also.
So
So
maybe
that's another
more
thing.
steroids than post-op.
Absolutely. So, so you need to be careful about that too.
Well, that's so I love talking about these tough cases because those are always the big challenges. It's like a mental puzzle you have to solve before you get to the operating room. But
Absolutely. Absolutely. It actually, Uday, when you have these cases, for me, I would at least take half an hour before the surgery. I just disconnect myself from everything in this world. And just thinking about that, what is going to be my protocol for this patient? If this happens, I do this. If this happens, I do this. If this happens, I do this. And I just disconnect from everything. And it is just me and my thoughts, and
I love it.
that's and with that, I go in my OR to handle these cases
Right.
because that this might work, this might not work. So you have to be ready with everything, what's going on out there.
Oh, I love these. Yeah, for the young surgeons, I do this as well. So in my schedule, I always place these patients at the end of my surgical schedule. So I want all the routine cases done. And I just, this, I usually have the toughest cases, my last case of the day, so there's just no rush. And then the night
Absolutely.
before, when I'm going to bed, I lie in bed and kind of play the surgery through my head and kind of imagine what I want to do. And I'll fall asleep.
Absolutely. 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 Yeah, that's how it works, actually. You need to have that focus, which has to
No,
come.
very true. How did you get into ophthalmology? How did you choose ophthalmology?
Well, that's in itself a very big story, because I loved pediatrics. I also wanted to be a pediatrician, but somehow I did not get into pediatrics, and this is how then I chose ophthalmology, and the rest is history. Like, so yeah,
Wow.
so
So you must also do some strabismus or squint surgery.
we do in our center. Yes,
Oh,
we do
fantastic.
lots of strabismus and squint surgeries. We do the glaucoma surgeries in our center, and we also do lots of cataracts and challenging cases and vitrectomies and iris repairs and all that stuff. So yeah, quite a bit of
Well,
things like
basically the whole spectrum then of all of ophthalmology, essentially.
yeah, because my husband is also an ophthalmologist. So yeah, we do have things, we divide our cases and like we do that. So yeah, it's fun actually.
It's
And
fun. Yeah.
hopefully my daughter joins in. So
Oh, that'll
I'll
be
be
fun.
having a third person in the family. Yeah.
Yeah, there are a lot. Ophthalmology is good like that. There's a lot of family connection in ophthalmology. Once someone does it, people find out the secret, like, wow, this is an amazing specialty. And then other family members, next generation joins in. It's neat.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's fun.
That's fantastic. So, what other challenging cases are you doing then? Do you also do glaucoma surgeries in your practice as well?
Yes, we do glaucoma surgeries also. So, but the most common surgeries that we do here are the trabeculectomies, the valves, and some, young cases like goniotomies, etc. So that's it. MIGS is something which is not yet caught up very well here in our part of the country. So yeah, but trabeculectomy results are fantastic for all those patients who actually need glaucoma surgery. And maybe we also do the laser trabeculoplasties and all. So yeah.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, it's nice to have the full kind of skill set for all these cases. So when I was teaching residents, which I retired from a couple years ago, when I did that for 20 years, we would do all the cases. So all the traumas coming in, all the cataracts, anterior segment stuff. I would do cornea surgeries with the residents. I'll do simple pterygium surgeries. We'll do glaucoma ones. We'll do Ahmed valves. I'll even teach the residents how to do diabetic PRP laser. We'll do everything.
Okay, great. That's nice.
And so the nice part is then you can do very complex cases all at once. Like we'd have a patient coming in with bad neovascular glaucoma. So probably bad proliferative diabetic retinopathy, not ever treated. You get the patient, they give them an Avastin injection in the clinic. The next day or two, you take them to the operating room, you take out the cataract. While they're aphakic, you put on the indirect of laser, you do their panretinal photocoagulation, you put the eye well in the eye, you put the omid valve in the eye, everything done, one sitting.
Correct. That sounds fantastic, yeah? That sounds fantastic, doing everything together. So that's great, nice.
Yeah, I think it's a neat way. If you have a very broad skill set, and I think with your type of practice, you have a really very wide range of skills.
Yeah, because see, for example, like Uday, if we have any traumatic case coming in, I would wind up everything in one shot. Like I would not be taking up the patient again for, you know, doing something else. So we would just go ahead and clean up everything, do a vitrectomy, do a secondary IOL, fix up the iris, fix up everything, and then come out of the eye. So, yeah.
Right. It's nice to be able to get it all done once. So for these cases where you're losing or you have no capsular support, are you preferring glued IOL technique, Yamane, scleral sutured? What's your preference?
I prefer to do glued IOLs, Uday. Because the results of glued IOL surgery is, they are very good in my hands. So I try to do that, basically. And the second advantage that I see with the glued IOL is, you know, is the IOL tilt I see less as compared to any other technique. So that's another advantage with this technique, because you create sclerotomies and you know exactly from where you are coming out and where it's not a blind procedure. Right. So you know actually how, you know, the sclerotomies are and where they are placed and exactly 180 degrees. And I think placement of sclerotomy is one of the most important thing for any secondary IOL fixation, right? Because that is what, you know, takes care of the IOL tilt in the postoperative period. So, yeah, I do lots of glued IOL cases for my patients, whoever they need it.
What I like with that technique is that the haptic has basically almost zero risk of coming out of the sclera and going through the conjunctiva. It's a nice long tunnel. The Cherioff tunnel is very long, yes, within the sclera. And so the fixation is really rock solid.
Yes, the fixation is very good. The only thing I think that a surgeon needs to be careful about is, you know, you should have a good amount of haptic externalization in these patients wherever you're doing it, you know. And like if you have about 2 to 3 millimeters of your haptic going into the scleral pocket, it's fantastic. You know, nothing can, you know, pull your IOL out of that place. So it's very secure that way.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges with Yamane, or the correct pronunciation, Yamane, is that the scleral tunnel, you have to be very careful to make it long enough, because most people err on the side of having it too short. So the actual tunnel length within the sclera is maybe a millimeter, millimeter and a half. And then you'll sometimes see the flange end of the haptic just sitting right out of the conjunctiva.
Yes, absolutely. So these are, I think, even with the Yamane, I would say that making up of flanges is also very important. You know, I think it's the correlation between the size of the needle that you are using along with the scleral tunnel that you have created. So then it depends, you know, the type of the flange that you create. And it also depends upon the type of the IOL that you are using, because it depends upon the material of the haptic of the IOL. You get a flange. So there are beautiful papers, you know, which have been published regarding the type of the flanges that you create in different, like PVDF haptics with PMMA haptics and other haptics, and, you know, having the correct gauge of the needle going through and creating those things. So I think, and it also depends upon where you hold the haptic, whether it is 0.5 millimeters away or 1 millimeter away. And, you know, so I think technically everybody has to be very sound with what you are actually doing. It's all science, basically, at the end of the day. And right. If you have those flanges being too much protruded, too much big flanges, obviously they're going to come up from the conjunctiva. Right. So you have to be very careful if you have done that. You know, you need to actually bury them into the sclera. The small trick, again, it is that, you know, wherever your haptic is coming out, and if you see that too much of bulge of the bulb from that area, you know, you need to, you can, what do is you can take up a needle and just scrap a little bit of the sclera out there and try to bury that flange inside. Never know that flange.
Yamane, you for sure want to bury the flange within the sclera. If it's just sitting under the conjunctiva, it will erode through.
It will erode through. So you have to be very careful. Even with glue dye also, dye, you know, if a surgeon creates, if you happen to create a very superficial pocket, you might end up, you know, and if your haptics are not tucked by a novice surgeon properly, you might have a haptic slippage coming up from that place. And many times, you know, if it's too superficial, I have seen one case wherein, you know, the haptic had, you know, it was so superficial. Even if you see those blue haptics coming up, it might erode through if you have not tucked them properly in the appropriate depth of the sclera. So that's again very important thing coming up with these techniques. You know, you have to be very careful with the depth of the scleral pocket that you have created, and
So,
even in glue dyes. Yes.
for you at a glued IOL, what depth are you going for? 50%, a little bit more?
Absolutely, 50% or maybe a little bit more. It shouldn't be superficial. Otherwise, you can have a problem there too.
Yeah, then we have to be careful too. Certain patients, like if you have a big myopic guy, 30 millimeter axial length, you may have even thinner scleral to begin with.
Yes,
Yeah,
correct.
that can be tough too.
Yes, it can be tough.
Yeah.
Plus, we also do customization. Like if you have a small eye, Uday, if you have a small eye, like when you do a wide-to-wide diameter and you're calculating, and like if you have a 10 or an 11 millimeter eye, you know, whenever you have these small eyes, you know, you will have too much of haptics coming out from both the sides. You may be having 4 or 5 millimeters on either side coming up. You have to trim it. And then you have to, you know, tuck them into the chariot pockets, because if you do not cut them, you know, they're too big to go into the scleral pocket then. So if you
Yeah,
have a
they're
small
small.
eye, you have to cut them.
Yeah, I know
And
small eyes are my least favorite eyes. I just feel
I think it's for everybody.
it's
Everybody, you know, you are going to have a tough time if you have a small eye. Everybody
right.
knows that.
When the
So
action length is less than 20, I'm just like, oh gosh, I don't want to do this one.
you have to be so careful with these eyes. Do you, Uday, I want to ask you, do you give preoperatively mannitol in these eyes when you have those small eyes?
In some cases we can. I don't, it just depends. I think there's almost no downside to the mannitol other than the patient has to urinate or void quite a bit before the procedure. But I think there's no real downside to doing it, so you may as well do it. But
Okay.
I don't do any of those scleral windows, and but you know, for these tiny eyes to prevent choroidal effusion, I don't do any of that.
Okay. Because I, in my practice, if I have those small eyes, the non-ophthalmic eyes and all, I do consider giving preoperative mannitol to these patients for decompression. And obviously, we have to be ready for any vitreous tap whenever it is necessary during the surgery. So do you consider doing a vitreous tap when
Well, the
necessary?
problem is, so you get an eye that's like 17, 18 millimeter axial length. Where's pars plana? I'm
Yeah,
kind of
that's.
afraid to go 3.5 millimeters back. I mean, I'm already gonna, am I gonna be in the retina?
Yes, that's true. That's true.
While I have done that technique in the past, I'm very cautious. And if you're gonna do a pars plana tap here, you know, you gotta check for entry site breaks, just like the retina surgeons do. So
Absolutely.
it's a lot more involved here. So generally, I see if I can do without that.
Okay, correct.
So those are stressful. That's why I don't like. I just wish I had a younger associate. Maybe one of my kids will join me. And like, I'll give them all the stressful cases. I'm ready to pass that on. Let me do the easy ones. Right. Let me specialize in the 2 to 3 plus nuclear sclerosis, Beverly Hills cataract. That's my favorite. Especially as I get older now, I'm like, that's what I like.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Those are stressful. But you know, I'm also in a different part of the world. You know what I've seen now recently, which is absolutely crazy to me, is because the patients can want to change their eye color, this a corneal keratopigmentation. They're using a femtosecond laser to create basically a donut lamellar dissection in the cornea, and then injecting like a tattoo ink in the stroma. This, you
Okay.
haven't seen this?
No.
Oh my gosh, this is I'm starting to see patients like this who had this done here in Los Angeles, because obviously patients here in Beverly Hills have a lot of cosmetic surgery, so they're used to doing all kinds of procedures all the time.
Okay. So how many cases do you get if somebody has gotten, the eye color change or
I've only
something?
seen two in person.
Okay.
It's all over, like your Instagram and your social media, and this is, it's really crazy. But they're not changing the iris color. What they're literally doing is they're using a femtosecond laser, like a VisuMax, basically, the VisuMax starts from the outside and goes inward to do the dissection. So it's like a LASIK flap dissection, but they stop it at like 4 millimeters. So the central 4 millimeters of the cornea is not dissected. Now you have a donut-shaped channel in the cornea.
Got that.
Then they put the ink dyes, tattoo ink dyes in that channel.
Don't tell me. I fail to understand why this has to be done.
Oh my, it's called keratopigmentation. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't look like a normal eye because you're not changing the iris color. You're putting ink in the cornea.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And then I
Oh,
just
and
wonder,
that's
how do you see at night when your pupil dilates to 6, 7 millimeters? How are you seeing? Because you've got the ink that's giving you an artificial 4 millimeter pupil. Speaking of pupil size, it's crazy.
absolutely.
And I
Yeah.
can't imagine how will someone do their cataract surgery in the future when you got to look through a 4 millimeter central spot in the cornea to do the whole surgery, and you can't see any of the rest of the anterior chamber because it's blocked off by ink.
It's so scary. It's so scary. Absolutely. So are these surgeries allowed to be done in the United States? Is it
So,
legal?
yeah, apparently it is. But I mean, there are also people here who do, and this will sound so crazy to you, and they're removing conjunctiva to make the eyes wider.
Oh, I don't
Is this,
believe it.
yes, this is the craziest thing. And then the eyes are absolutely white because then you take off the conjunctiva that's discolored or has pigmentation in it or whatever, and then the epithelial cells will obviously grow back over it. But now you've taken away their. I mean, it's crazy. It's
It's crazy.
absolutely. But this is done here. I mean, for me, it fails my one important test, which is the golden rule. I give the surgery that I'd want to receive. And don't ever do those things to my eyes. Don't tattoo my cornea if I don't need it. And don't take away
Absolutely.
my time. But people are doing it here. But you also seen crazy plastic surgery, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is like I've never heard this that you just remove conjunctiva. I mean, that's so scary. I'm still trying to get over it.
Yeah, so you know how some people have, like, especially a darker skinned person may have a little bit of pigmentation in their conjunctiva, right?
Yeah,
And so they don't
right.
like it. They want their eyes to look whiter. But this is the
Okay.
same time. There's the same population here in Beverly Hills who will get their teeth bleached, like, so they're so white they look like they're radioactive, right? Or they'll do so much crazy plastic surgery. But I guess, everyone's got their own population. I have a problem with some of my patients that you may not even heard of, which is some of my patients have had cataract patients have had so much plastic surgery. When I put the speculum in to do the cataract surgery, I can only open it 7 or 8 millimeters.
Oh.
I can't open the lids anymore.
So
And
how
then
do you manage that? How
you
do you
just do
manage?
it. You just you iso temporal, the big one
Correct.
iso temporal.
That's
And
the
then
only
you
way.
just operate. What can you do? Because if you crank the speculum, well, now you may cause some levator dehiscence or ptosis. Can't do that.
Correct.
But
Oh.
I'd say a reasonable. I would say at least 5% of my patients, when I put a speculum in, and they've had a very tight bleph, I can't even open the speculum all the way. I can't see limbus to
Oh, so you have different problems in your part of the world.
limbus. That's the funniness of ophthalmology, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's all cosmetic kind of things, and their after effects. So that's, I think some of the trends are very dangerous, till you are getting things done on your skin and everything, that's okay. But when it comes to doing and touching your eyes for nothing, it makes absolutely no sense. Like, they're so precious eyes, how can you even think of doing those things I mean, you can think of doing it on your own eyes, so doing it on somebody else would be like something.
Right. I mean, I think it's just different depending, which city you're in, which part of the world you're in. If you're in Singapore or let's say in Hong Kong, then the rate of myopia is very high. So now you've got a lot of cataract patients who've had LASIK because it's much more common because there's myopia is more than half the population. Right?
Oh,
So those are very myopic populations.
correct,
So whereas
correct.
with me, I've got a lot of plastic surgery type patients have those kind of issues. There are other parts of the world where people have really just very small eyes, shallow AC's, very common. Or some of these Scandinavian countries where like half the population has pseudoexfoliation.
Correct, correct.
So that's the fun about the money. It's all a little bit different.
Absolutely, but I'm so delighted. I've come to know so many things about, you know, the problems that you face differently as compared to us. Because here, the maximum thing that comes up is, you know, the eye color change, or somebody has got that cosmetic thing into the eye, and it's a big mess, you know, removing them, and you know, doing, because these patients, they come up with secondary glaucomas and everything, and with cataracts, and you know, all those stuff.
This is the artificial iris that they put on top of your regular iris.
Absolutely.
And so what are the problems you're seeing with that?
The problem is that, you know, these patients, they develop glaucoma over a period of time because, you know, you have that thing lying entirely onto the surface of the iris. Although you have the change in the color of the iris, but actually that's not the place where it is. And secondly, you know, plus you have those endothelial decompensations coming up because, you know, it's directly in the angle. So, and then, you know, once, Uday, I've seen that once you start getting that UGH syndrome in your eye, these eyes, you know, whatever you do, they take a lot to come back to the normal. It's a downside. Absolutely. It's a downside going on because, you know, even if you remove those implants, they need so many multiple surgeries. They might need a cataract. They might need a cornea transplant or an endothelial keratoplasty and you know, doing a glaucoma surgery in these patients. Because once the angles and everything is damaged, these patients, they actually do not respond very well to any topical anti-glaucoma medications. So these are very tricky cases, and it beats my mind that, you know, why anybody would like to even do such kind of surgery for the patients. Yeah, because I think, but another point what I've seen is that if I say no to that patient, you know, that patient goes somewhere else and gets it done. So I don't know. Yeah. Why?
They want it.
Yeah, they're going to find somebody who does it for them.
Right. It's like you see some patients who've had so much plastic surgery, you think, you don't need any more. But yet they go and find a surgeon who will do more.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's...
But yeah, those artificial irises were terrible. These are the cosmetic implants that are like silicone or something else that are sitting on top of the iris. Because, yeah, they're right. They go and they scar up your angle.
Correct.
Right? Scarred up angle. So now that even the top glaucoma drops won't do anything, they damage the underlying normal brown iris. They
Absolutely.
Cause endothelial decompensation of the cornea, and they probably induce a cataract too. So it's like they just destroy your entire anterior segment.
Absolutely. And it's a mess. It's a mess then. Yeah. These eyes, they do not recover very well in the postoperative period, and they take a lot of time to come back to their normal, even after doing trying to rectify everything that has been done wrong to them. Even if you rectify them, it doesn't come back to its original thing like before.
Yeah, you can't make it normal again. You can make it help them, but it won't be perfect ever again.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, I saw one of those patients where I actually saw the patient, this is many years ago, who had the surgery done somewhere in Central or South America, came back to the U.S. I think he had done in Panama. And then I saw the eyes, it looked crazy to me, had all these problems that we just talked about. And I said, you really need to get this surgery done. You got to take that thing out and do it. He's like, no, I don't want to lose. I want to keep my blue eyes.
Absolutely.
So I ended up sending him to the university. And he ended up getting as you can imagine, everything, multiple surgeries that removed that thing, then an almond valve for the glaucoma, then a corneal endothelial transplant, and then cataract, pupil reconstruction. It was just a hot mess. And like, I still wanted blue, I missed my blue eyes.
So that's where this, you know, the femto kind of a thing would work for these patients if they want that blue thing.
Yeah, I guess it's better than putting this in the inside your anterior chamber. I mean, it just fails my golden rule. It's like, I wouldn't do it to my own eyes, so I don't want to do it to you. I wouldn't do it to my kids ever. So then I Correct. Wouldn't do it to you. So.
Correct. Correct. I do agree to that fact. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the easiest. That's the best way of medicine.
Yeah, true. True.
Well, what's new on your horizon? What did you, at the ASRS, did you see anything, any new technology that you have interest in or new techniques? What was the highlight of your meeting? Because you made a long trip all the way to LA to come to the meeting.
Yeah, I did make a long trip. Yes, absolutely. But for me, I think the things that I actually, that take home message for me from this ASCRS meeting was that, trying to get into and trying to, go ahead with some of the path-breaking things that would be the future, the first thing that would be how to incorporate the artificial intelligence into the, into the practice, how, and, how we can pass on this benefit to the patients. So I think some of the surgeons here, even they are, analyzing the data that they have from their patients and, trying to pile up the entire data. Because I think, Uday, the future belongs to AI and it belongs to the data of the patient. And the higher the number of data that you have of your patients, and compiling the data together and trying to get into the system of, incorporating AI for your patients and getting the benefit out of it. And maybe, so that is something, one thing which I look forward to. And maybe in near future, I would like to incorporate that into my practice and into my system as such. But as far as surgical things are concerned, I honestly feel I'm doing quite well. So that's okay. So that's my point.
My take-home message from ASRS is, first, it's great to connect with friends.
Yeah, that is absolutely, that's
That's
always.
always the best part of it in the meetings, is to connect with colleagues and friends in person. But in terms of learning, I just find these days I do most of my surgical or ophthalmology learning online.
Absolutely. That's another thing that's going to
No
come
longer
up.
the meetings.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
And
my
then,
ASCRS take home was I connected to Uday.
you're very
Although
sweet.
we have met before in
Of
other
course.
conferences. I met you in the All India also here in
But
India.
it was nice to have dinner together.
Yes, it was nice to have dinner together, sit around, chat around, and yeah, that was the icing on the cake.
Oh, you're very kind. But yeah, I think the LA att the attendance, the ASRS in Los Angeles was a little bit down. I think it was probably, to me, I'm just guessing, it felt like it was 50% attendance. Like, it was pretty low attendance in terms of
Yeah.
physicians. And then even a lot of the great lecturers had kind of small rooms that were mostly empty. They really, I just
Yeah.
thought, I think people have made that shift now. Like, even my course that I did at the ACRS, it's all going to be on cataractcoach.com. It's going to be there. You can
I
watch
was
it.
there for your course. I
Oh,
saw your
thank you.
course. Yes,
It
I
was
was there.
fun. But all
Yeah.
those 12 cases, I'm going to put them on one a day for 12 days on Cataract Coach, so the rest of the world can see it.
Yeah, but yes, coming up to what you're saying, Uday, I feel yes, online learning online has taken up a big thing. People would love to learn online, because even for cataract coach, so much of educational stuff is there. I mean, like you just switch on to the thing and like you have all sorts of videos coming in and learning and everything. So I think yes. And the second thing is, going up to conferences, it's like for specifically for us, it's a travel time. It's so much. It
Yeah.
takes so much of
There
energy.
is no direct flight from anywhere in India to Los Angeles. None.
No. So like it takes for us 24 hours to fly in, 24 hours to fly back and everything. But yes, I love being connected to all my friends and colleagues. So I'm always there for ASCRS and coming up to Academy and everything. So it's fun being there. But yes, online learning has taken up a very big thing. It's a big thing.
Right. And then what helps me too is
And the
sometimes,
credit goes to you.
oh no, I'm just a small part of a big thing. For the probably the credit should go to Osher, who's like the godfather of all surgical video. That's how I first started learning with videos. Right, 25 years ago, I'd watch his videos. He was just a huge mentor to me. But yeah, I like to be able to like see the video and then see it again and then see it again. It takes me a
Absolutely.
couple of times to see it and really understand it and pick up the subtleties. And so I'd go to a live lecture, I just see it once and it's gone.
And you know that what I see in the videos, I always see the hand movements of the surgeon.
Interesting.
That is the thing to see and analyze whenever, for example, I see any video, even if it is your video or if it is anybody else's video. What I focus is how is the surgical hand moving? Because that is what decides that how you are going to do. You know how to fix a CTR, but you should know how the surgeon is inserting it inside, how the hand is moving and going in,
Angle and
and
yeah.
how it is going, because you don't want to struggle at that point of time. So these are, fine things in the video learning that comes up. It's the surgical hand of the surgeon, how the hand moves, how the hand handles, how the instruments get transferred from one hand to the other, how you pick up the sutures, how you go, how you enter, how you come out. So these are the main thing coming up from, any surgical video.
No, you're right. The subtleties make all the difference. Like we brought up, just putting in a CTR. I still remember the first time I put a CTR, and I said, "Well, just put it in." It's not that simple. Because,
Absolutely.
I know I want the CTR that's the one that's preloaded, but to the left. And
Correct.
why? Because I'll inject it with my right hand through the main incision, and then I want my Sinski hook in the para, which is on the left hand, to get the leading islet, and then slowly, and then even that. It's a two-handed technique. As I inject with the one hand, the left hand is holding the islet. I guide that around gently before dropping it.
Absolutely, absolutely. So these are the things that make the difference when you're putting any device inside the eye. So.
Yeah. I think the other really neat thing is we've now equalized surgical learning worldwide. Because I remember being
Correct.
a resident where there were these secrets and no one teaches you what are these little secrets, these little pearls. And well, now it's for everyone. And like if I, as long as I'm alive, I'm telling all the secrets to everyone. Just
Absolutely.
let's all
That
learn
is where
together.
the that's that that's where the learning comes in. I want to know that how many videos do you edit in a week? A surgical week.
There's a new cataract coach video every single day.
Correct.
Today's we're almost at 2,600 videos. I've never missed a day. It's a new one every day for about 8-ish years.
Amazing.
And now we have Retina Rounds too with as our sister channel. And we started that March 1. So now we're coming on 100 videos there. New one every day also for Retina Rounds.
Wow, that's
So,
huge. That's
yeah.
huge.
And then Cataract
Okay.
Coach is not just cataract. We also do everything anterosegment. So there's going to be every week, there's at least one glaucoma video. We feature cornea videos, refractive surgery videos too, anything anterosegment. Or like yours, complex anterosegment things like pupilloplasty. So it's more than just cataract. Cataract is obviously what we, for all of us as ophthalmologists, anterosegment surgeons, that's our number one surgery is cataract.
Correct, correct,
That's why
correct.
it's cataract coach.
Fantastic. And from where did you get this motivation to do and start the cataract coach? I'm so interested to know
Okay,
that.
I'm going to tell you. Well, I've always taught residents for 22 years. I did it from the age of 30 to age 52. And I'm retired from that. But when I was teaching residents, I had always videos online. If you look carefully, you can find a YouTube video of me operating, many of them, from 15, 18, almost 20 years ago. They were low definition, 640 by 480. They weren't high
Correct.
definition.
Correct.
And I'd upload those. And I had a lot of good material, but I wanted it all in one place. I said, let me make a
Okay.
website, cataractcoach.com. So now the videos, the same content is on the website, cataractcoach.com. It's on the YouTube video. It's on Instagram. It's on Facebook. It's on LinkedIn all the
Yes.
same time every day.
I saw that. Yes.
Yeah, so
And
it's a
who does that? Like you put in the videos. You have some person doing it for you, or you do it yourself?
well, I have to do it. Here's the problem. Even though I live in LA and Hollywood is right here, if I hired a professional Hollywood video editor, well, he or she doesn't know what a capsular rexus is.
Correct.
Teach him. How do I say how do I say here's a complex 45-minute long anterior segment reconstruction case. Can you edit it to 5 minutes? They have no idea what to put.
Correct. Okay, so you're doing it all yourself and like putting it up on the social media and everything, you do it yourself.
Yeah, but I just schedule it. It's all automated. Like if I
Ah.
die tomorrow, you'll think it's a conspiracy because the next 30 days the video will still be posted. You're like, no, he's got to be alive. But no, it's just scheduled.
Okay.
So here,
Okay.
I'll show you something funny. You know what this is? This is your gown card, right?
Yeah.
This is just from the I save these to make notes on, and I'll make a list like there you go. Those are all the cases I've lined up for here. This is the month of May, all the videos.
Oh my.
So,
Oh
and
my.
I'm a -2 myope, so I write really tiny.
Oh, great. So
I can't even.
that's a right power to have. -2. It's great.
The best. Okay,
That's the best.
100%.
Even I have minus 1.5 in one of my eyes, so I can see tenno without even a microscope.
Yeah, that's no, that's fantastic. But no, so yeah, I got into the videos myself, but it's just we equalize surgical education. Now the world can learn together and there are going to be no more secrets. And
absolutely.
That's the beauty of this whole thing.
Correct. Correct. Absolutely. Teaching never ends and it never stops.
I also learn. I learn more than I teach, let me tell you.
Absolutely.
People send me videos. I receive 50 videos about every week from viewers. And I edit it down and I only feature one a week, I mean, one a day. So it's seven a week, basically, seven videos a week, one a day. Most I don't feature, but I watch everyone that sent to me.
Correct.
And I was, let me learn, like, wow. And some are great videos, but maybe they're out of focus because it's a young surgeon who's overaccommodating, the video is blurry. So I can't feature the video, but I can learn from it still.
Absolutely.
This has exploded. It's expanded so much in the last 8 years because just every day I'm just watching these videos.
And you must be getting lots of submissions for your cataract coach, you know?
Yeah, 50 a week.
Wow, that's again.
50 submissions every week.
And then you have to sit and review them?
I go through every one.
Yeah, and then you have to, you choose them and, you know, and then you put them. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a full-time job, Uday. I don't know. I mean, hats off to you. Hats off to you. It's a full-time job. You have to be really passionate to do that. Otherwise it doesn't happen like, you know.
My kids say passionate or maybe crazy or maybe both.
Anyway, I have seen, you know, all those people who succeed in life.
Yeah.
You may call them crazy, but they have something differently in them and their craziness leads to their success, I would say.
Yeah, I call it passion, hard work and passion is kind of all it is.
Yeah, it's hard work and passion for you, but it might be something crazy for somebody. But that is what actually leads to success in life. You need to have that edge of craziness in you to succeed. I believe that.
Yeah, I think you do. It's at some point you got to have that drive within you.
Absolutely.
I'm going to do this. I mean, look, even this conversation today, how you talked all these important pearls to me. I'm like, oh, taking notes. Now, the next time I do a fourth of pupilloplasty, I'm going to do it from the backside and I'm going to start out and come in so I can still access it. Now I know, see?
Okay, great. I look forward to seeing any of your videos whenever they come up with the reverse flow through. I would love to see that.
I will definitely do it. So we're going to feature your video tomorrow, basically, or the day after this podcast airs would be your video. So if you listen to the podcast, definitely check Cataract Coach for Dr. Narang's video about the pupilloplasty. You will learn a lot. It'll be a very useful technique for you and your patients. Definitely check it out.
Thank you so much.
Welcome. Priya, I want to thank you for being on this podcast. Can you imagine we've been talking for more than an hour already?
Yeah, I know. And we didn't even come to know about it.
Right.
It was fantastic. Fantastic, Uday, being here with you. With this conversation, I could pick up so many things from what you have. And somewhere down the line, I feel I have some passions that meet yours. So it's good to get connected to you so much. Yeah, thank absolutely. You so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you again. And I'll remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new Cataract Coach video every single week, every single day, a new podcast every single week. It's on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you get your podcast, you'll find the Cataract Coach podcast. We also have a Retina Rounds podcast every Sunday also. And of course, Retina Rounds, our sister channel, also has a new retina video every single day. Let's keep learning together. Let's equalize that surgical education worldwide. So until next time, I'll check you later.